Yeah, I love black and white. It's, to me, it's much more stronger. It leaves something behind for the imagination, and everything is in color.
Hallo und willkommen. Hamburg Arts, das ist ein Podcast mit Themen und Geschichten aus der Kunstwelt. Und ich bin Kai Detlefs, Journalist in Hamburg. Sein Thema ist die bedrohte Arktis mit den langsam schmelzenden Gletschern und den Menschen dort, die darunter leiden. Der Fotograf Ragnar Axelsson macht Bilder vom Leben in der Arktis seit 40 Jahren. Seine Themen: Klimakrise und globale Erwärmung. Er gilt als herausragender Reportage- und Naturfotograf. Axelsson lebt in Island, das heißt, er ist Augenzeuge der Klimakrise, und das macht seine Schwarz-Weiß-Bilder aus Island, Grönland und Sibirien so glaubwürdig und einzigartig. Diese Fotografien sind jetzt in Hamburg zu sehen, im Foxy bei den Deichtorhallen. Titel der Ausstellung: Where the World is Melting. Es geht um unsere schmelzende Welt. Im Foxy habe ich Ragnar Axelsson zum Interview getroffen. Das Gespräch haben wir auf Englisch geführt.
Well, the title is actually taken from a text I wrote in a book, and all the photographs in the exhibition are actually taken on places where it's warming up and it is melting, like the sea ice and the glaciers, and also the villages, like in Greenland, they are been abandoned, some of them. So it's because of the melting. It's a documentary thing to photograph and documenting life on those remote places, and everything is melting actually there.
You are living in Iceland, so in a way you are an eyewitness of the climate crisis, right?
Yeah, I am. I've been there for 40 years going, and I've seen like so much drastic changes. It's like the fjords that was frozen 25 years ago, they're now open water. You sail, otherwise you go on a sled dog and a deck, and then you sail by boat. And also when you go and visit them, the people over and over again, and you learn from them, and you talk to them, and they tell you, and they have worries about what's happening. And like my friend Hjalmar is a hunter from Itukatormit in East Greenland. He's, when I asked him, I saw in his eyes that he was worried, and I was photographing him, that if I could give you one wish, what would it be? And he said, give me 25 years back in time when the sea ice was safe. So it's hard to photograph sometimes, you know, to show, you just see sea ice, it's just white, but it's thinning, so it's more dangerous as it used to be. You know, like sometimes we were on Dockstad that was pretty safe, and then suddenly you're in a, like you're riding a wave, you know, it's so thin that you can't jump off the sled, or you would fall through the ice. So you go by the moment, you know, you have to go fast. So I've seen it, I've sensed it, yeah, it's a lot I've seen.
So what are your thoughts about this global warming and the climate crisis?
Well, I grew up on a farm as a kid, in the summer, 8 summers, and I was measuring the glaciers at the time. There were scientists, all 5 brothers and 2 sisters, and they were all scientific-minded people and doing all kinds of research. So I saw the glaciers retreat then. They were getting smaller, slowly, and I wasn't thinking about climate change then or anything like that. But it came later on. I was in Thule when an old man was. I passed his house, and he said something wrong. It shouldn't be like this. The big ice is sick. So I started thinking about it more. And the glaciers in Iceland, for instance, they have been bigger. They have been smaller. But now our planet is in the phase of warming up, and probably we're not helping. And I leave it to scientists to tell us. And I just, my role is documenting life that is changing or will fade away in some cases, like the abandoned villages. People move because their hunting grounds are gone, because the sea ice isn't safe, so they move, and it's not sustainable anymore. So that's part of it. So I think I had a responsibility, and we do have, to document this kind of life. And my feeling about it is quite, you know, sad, and it would be stupid to ignore it that this is happening. But I want scientists to tell us, and it supports what they're doing, to what I'm doing, I think, when we're showing life that is the consequences of this, you know, in the Arctic. The people living in the Arctic, and they have very little to do with what is happening, the melting of their hunting grounds on the sea ice. It's happening somewhere else. The pollution is somewhere else on Earth.
And do these people understand in the Arctic? Do they understand what's going on? Can they really understand this?
They understand it quite well. And like the old man who said that about the glacier, there's something wrong. The big ice is sick and shouldn't be like this. They sensed it before, I think. Most people realized what was happening at the time, because scientists knew, and that it was warming and it was changing. And they kind of like walking on a page in the book we read about. So you get a lot of knowledge and information from them, and they are very worried about it. They sense it more than anybody else.
Now, let's talk about, this very special photography. The curator, Ingo Taubhorn, he said there are these iconic pictures in this exhibition. Are you looking for these impressive iconic pictures, or how do you work?
No, I just try to capture moments in someone's life, freeze a moment in someone's life that will last, that never coming back, will last forever. And I tried to photograph I wanted to be a painter. I couldn't paint or draw, so my father got it. My father's Leica borrowed when I was 10 years old, so my pencil was my camera. And I was looking through books about from artists, great painters and photographers, also buying magazines from Germany, England, America, France. So I wanted to take those pictures. But you learn a lot from watching great old masters of painters to see how they compose things. And you never know when a photograph becomes a legendary photograph or an iconic photograph, because if you look at, for instance, there are many, like a little girl running from the napalm bomb in Vietnam, it changed people's mindset. And Eugene Smith, when he photographed Minamata in Japan, when they put pollution in the water and kids were born disabled. So those photographs change things. So you never know when it happens. There's a lot of competition showing pictures today on the planet. There's so much ongoing. But I decided with my friends, we made our own publishing company, and now we're in cooperation, like with Kerr, to do books. And we decided to do books about the Arctic. And because it's important to do it, all ice will be, in my opinion, facing to the Arctic in coming years, if it continues to be like that. But I don't want to scare people. I always want to have hope, you know, and everybody has hope. Because when we were young, we were scared of nuclear war around the planet. So there was worries that was not good to have. You know, it's the same thing with young generation are very worried and doing things that trying to open people's eyes. But we must have hope, and people are working on, you know, saving it, everything. But the planet has been warmer before, and it has been colder.
You said you are looking for the very best picture, and you go on with your work, and you get even a better picture, okay? This is some sort of philosophy of you, right?
Yeah. I think when you think you have the good picture, then you're through, and it's over for you. You're always looking for a good picture, and it takes a lifetime. And I'm happy with some of my photographs, but I never always felt like I could have done better. So I'm still trying to do better. It's like writing a song. You write a good song, then you have to write a better one, or try to outsmart and make the next one better. And it's the same in photography and all art, I think, also. You just continue improving.
You mentioned the American photographer Mary Ellen Mark, okay?
Yeah.
You knew her. So, and she had some sort of influence on you, right?
Yeah. Mary Ellen was a friend of mine. She passed away in 2015, and she was a great woman and one of the greatest photographer on the planet. The passion she had was enormous. It was, I mean, she was older than me and she had more power, even though just before she died, she was working and became very good friends. And her husband, Martin Bell, filmmaker, we're great friends. And she had an impact on me when I, you know, saying that when I was taking a photograph, I thought I had the picture. And she said, "Why did you stop? I had the picture." "No, you never have it. Just keep on taking pictures. You never know the moment when it will come, the real moment." So it helped me, like in Greenland when I was photographing my friend and I thought we were heading back home on a dog sled and I thought I had the picture of him and I was packing my gear because it was so cold. And I heard her voice saying, "Don't stop." I remembered it when she said it and I was like replying in this, "Do you know how cold it is here?" And she said, "I don't care. Keep on taking pictures." So I had to put my gear up even though I was freezing. And the moment, the picture that I got was, that was the moment that I was trying to get, and I got it because I didn't stop. The picture that I thought I had was not good enough. So I always, when I go to Greenland or wherever I go, I have her in mind, you know, for listening to what she said, because she was a very clever woman. And it's a good drive and a passion. You have to have a drive and passion for what you're doing. Otherwise, it won't work.
Your compositions of pictures are very special. Sometimes you're breaking the rules. For example, people are at the edge of a picture. Why do you do this? What do you have in mind?
I have only one rule, and it's breaking all the other rules. So it's... I think it's just happened by coincidence in a way. It's just my feeling of what I see and what I want to tell. I don't crop the pictures. I just take them. Mary Ellen told me, don't crop them. Just do it as you take them. So, and if you make a mistake, then you're just stuck with that mistake. And I don't totally agree on it, though, because we had great photographers who cropped their pictures, like Eugene Smith, and it was, I think, to me, it's okay. But I start working like that. So it's good to work like that and try to get the frame right and the moments right in one single frame. Like Cartier-Bresson was one of the greatest on earth to do that. And just looking at that, it's a challenge. And you feel better when you do it that way.
So, I mean, what are you doing in let's say, post-production? Mm. Do you do anything on with your pictures?
I do what I can do in a darkroom with digital work. My rules for myself are very strict as a documentary photographer and documenting things. You cannot cheat on things. You cannot change anything. You can take things out. You cannot add things on it. So you have to be, I just burn and dots as I have thousands of hours in the darkroom using film. And those magical moments, seeing a photograph come slowly up in the developer is a magical thing. And I just burn in dots in the darkroom and make the picture. It took me sometimes days to make one good print. And it's the same thing now when I do digital work. I just go as I could do in a darkroom. I don't go over the edges in sharpening things like that. You see a lot of photographs today in color. The colors in them don't exist on this planet. That's not right in documentary work.
It's talking about colors. I mean, you're working on black and white.
Yeah, I love black and white. To me, it's much more stronger. It leaves something behind for the imagination, and everything is in color. And you can, when you're, you know, working on the photographs like you do in a darkroom, you kind of put the atmosphere in it, or thing you want to tell. And the reason we made our own company, because we don't want to be, we just want to do the things the way we want to do it, you know, instead of having somebody telling you how to paint your picture or paint your painting. I mean, we do it the way, if we follow the rules or not, making the documentary work as it is, you know, without changing things, then we do it, you know, by the rule in a way. We do it so it's reliable.
Okay, at the same time, you are talking about paintings and painters quite often. So, and about the arts. So, in how far are you an artist, an activist? You know what I mean?
Mm. Me as an activist? Yeah,
right. Are you an activist? Are you an artist? Are you in some respect a painter?
I do respect the painters, and I learn from them. The old masters, more or less, because art world now today, some artists can't paint at all. And so I look at those as a picture, you know. So I look at and learn from that, and I see how they compose things and how they the expression of people's faces and all kinds of position people are in, and just, you know, the light in it. So it's, you learn a lot from that. You could, everybody, a photographer could learn a lot from that. But as an activist, I wouldn't say I am an activist, no, because I'm just documenting. I know what's happening. I've been working on those pages in that book of, you know, so I've seen things. And but I want scientists. I won't go on their field to tell us what they will have to tell us. But I don't. We would not want to. I understand those young generation that are worried. And but I don't think it's right to destroy paintings by putting red paint on it or something like that. It's not the right thing. And I think if you stop all the wheels right away, there would be a war around the planet. So you have to do it by in a wise way. You know, it's there are people all everybody's working on it now, I think, more or less. I mean, some people don't believe that there's nothing happening, but that's not right, and it would be extremely stupid to ignore it. And I've been hit on when my photographs, a lot of people say there's nothing happening, and it's been done, all been done before. And I say, yeah, but there were now there are more people on the planet, and it's speeding up much more than it ever had done because of pollution made by us. So I know what's happening, and but I don't want to scare people. The young people have to be, you know, live their life, and they want to. We cannot. Not everybody can be very famous on shouting on streets. You know, it has to be done the way that our planet will survive things. You know, in good manners.
How are chances? I mean, you're talking about the planet should survive. I mean, how do you count for the chances?
I'm optimistic, but I trust the scientists. You know, and I trust. People will. There will be the one who will find a real solution will be the biggest name on the planet ever. You know, it's so I'm waiting for, and I'm constantly looking and for like what is possible to do. And I think there is people. There are people, you know, telling us, and it's taking in with people. But if you stop everything, like flipping a switch, I don't know what would happen. It was. So that's dangerous too, but we must think and stop doing some of our activities to you know, stop things, the warming up.
Let's talk about your work, let's say in Greenland. I mean, how do you work? It's an extreme environment, okay? It can be extremely cold. How do you deal with the environment?
That's something that... the environment in Greenland is harsh, and in Siberia, I train for it. I play football, so played, and I go swimming in the ocean. I did every day for 3 years, but then COVID came, so we couldn't go in. And you take so that was a training to train you for this extreme cold, but you actually never can actually. So you have to be very careful, wearing great gear, warm clothes, and you're not allowed to make big mistakes like I did when I took one photograph of the hunter, when I took my one layer of my gloves off and my fingers froze. It still hurts. But the moment was something I wanted to capture, and I wasn't thinking because I was so excited getting that moment. I feel kind of stupid of having my fingers frozen, but things like that happen. I'm glad I did it in a way, because the picture is something that is going to be, it might be an iconic photograph in 50, 100 years, or 50 or 100 years, you know, you never know.
How do you approach these people in these areas? I mean, how do you get along with these people?
I go over and over again, and I visit them, and I get them to know me and gain their trust, and I go with them. And when you're with them for some time on the sea ice or in a tent or in a small cabin, we start to get closer and closer as friends, and I became one of them kind of when I'm with them. And I'm like a fly on the wall, so I can capture the moments as things happen instead of going. I wouldn't feel right if I went there for, you know, half an hour and took a picture of someone. I would feel like when you don't know anything about it or the person or it might be a good photograph, but I think it's for me to have the feeling of, you know, knowing them and like writing down what they say and giving them a voice by and show they show me give me the trust they show me the trust that I can do it and they trust me, so being with them is great actually. And you have to be there over and over again. I do that. I've done it. I always come and visit them and say hi. And
there's this one striking picture of this old man. You know, you showed this picture yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, how did you, I mean, I love the story about this picture. How did you take this picture and in what kind of scenery?
It was a moody day, like kind of foggy. And the ocean current was strong. It was hitting the rocks. And I've been visiting him a few times, and it was probably on the third or fourth time I visited him. And we were walking on the beach. He was looking for a mink that was killing his eider ducks, and he was angry. So that was the best mood I could see in his face. So it was like seeing a history of a whole country on one face. And it was just a moment that came. I was waiting. I was looking through the camera, I was waiting for the wave and hoping. And then the wave hit, and it broke on the rocks. And he looked up and looking for the mink. And it was a moment that it's just one picture. It's on film. And it's just one photograph, one picture, I have taken many other pictures of him, but I never tried to outsmart that one. I think I couldn't do it because it was kind of a perfect moment in it. But it's if I was a musician and it was a music, it would be my yesterday. But I want to continue writing like Here Comes the Sun or other songs, great songs. And it's the same with pictures. I want to continue to do other work.
And the story, now the story goes further, right? I mean, there's the story about these film companies who approached this guy, and now what happened then? So
that was funny. Yeah, it was fun. We got very famous when that picture ran in the paper where I worked, and it was very big. And I think he was in few advertisements, three or four, and two films. He was not the main actor, but he was like there because of his look, his beard, and all that. And I was really happy about that. And there was once that he was asked to play in an ad, and he called me, and they called the company called me and said, "Well, you have to, I'll ask him, but you have to pay him the same as the others. Don't cheat on him." So, and they did, and then he called me and said, "You have money here." "What?" "Yeah, they paid me so much." "Well, it's not my money, it's your money." So he was so humble and grateful for that. But he had fun doing it. He was not for everybody. He was kind of, didn't want to talk to everyone. But he was the kindest person, you know. And when he was in the film, he had fun doing it. And I urged him to do what he did. And then that was, he kind of called me, "Can I do this?" And I said, "Yes, it's going to be fun. Just do it." And I was really proud seeing him in an advertisement in America or here in Europe.
and he's living where exactly?
He lived in Iceland. He lived in Dyrhólaey, south coast of Iceland. He passed away a few years ago.
Okay, I see. Let's talk about Greenland for a while. There are these people living in an extreme environment. How do these people manage this?
They're very tough people, actually. They are living in condition most people wouldn't live in. I mean, but they especially, they have also, like in the big cities, it's fine. I mean, that's like here in a way, but it's not the same though. But in the smaller communities where they have to go out and hunt, that's really tough, actually. And the young generation go to school and don't want to be, or less and less want to be hunters because it's a tough life. You go out in the sea ice alone in a dog sled, and so you're in the beautiful environment. It's all right with that. Some just absolutely love it and want to do it all their life. But I think young generation that get educated, they want to see a different kind of life. But to survive in, you have to be, they know it, how to survive in the clothes and everything. And they are aware of all the dangers, and they know, they're like part of nature. They read the book like just by looking at it.
It looks ancient, okay? It's almost medieval. It's just bizarre in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks. There are a few villages like that left, kind of. There's some, around 13 villages has been abandoned, and So you see those villages when they're going down. It's like, and then the wind and the weather takes over. You know, they're just destroying. But
what kind of people are they? I mean, in terms of characters, what characters do you find there? These fishermen, for example, hunters.
They are really great. Most of them, I'm doing books, the book about the old eight Arctic countries, like a journey, and most of the people I meet, and I've been in all of them, it's really nice people, actually, when you get to know them. And they're funny, they're strong and tough. And if you watch a movie with a famous actor that gets a real credit in talk shows and whatever, the real hero are the people like that, in like, James Bond is out on the sea ice, if I may say so, because and they have a lot to say. They're even more funny than the actor, and they're never spoken to. That's how the world is. It's about celebrity, but those people are the ones who the films are based on sometimes, if I could make it like that, like a picture in words. So I admire them a lot, and they're very nice, and they're tough, and they can be, you know, they can be, you know, when they're really on out hunting, they can be angry or something like that. But it's not angry. It's like, and they have a good sense of humor, and makes you feel well when you're around them. And yeah, it shortens the day when they are seeing the same thing all over again for weeks.
Would you like to tell us something about the company you founded? There's a new company you created. You founded with other people, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
We three friends that made started that publishing company to make books exhibition. We want to do it just to open people's eyes for how life is in the Arctic. So we decided to make that company, start that company, because you don't have time to go to publishers who thinking for 3 years. That's not me. And we're running against time. The time is running out from us to document things that are disappearing, and they're disappearing much faster than I even thought that it would.
You published a book called Arctic Heroes about the sled dogs in Greenland.
Yeah.
So how about these dogs, and why are they heroes?
Oh, they are heroes. They're really big heroes. They kept the Inuits alive. Without the Greenlandic sled dog, there wouldn't be any Inuits. You know, it's their engine on the sled dog, and they're taking them places, and they couldn't have hunted, you know, without them. So it's a remarkable dog. It's one of the oldest dog breeds in the world, and they are very, extremely clever. The ones where they when everything is over in a bad weather or storm, the dog take you home, and I wrote down stories from hunters about that. So those stories are beautiful, and I thought it was difficult to get because they didn't find them remarkable, found it kind of silly, but it wasn't at all. And they had their favorite dogs and told me stories from them, like Kendu, which we named our company after Kendu, and then, for instance, like the story of Kali Piri, he was the son of Robert Piri, admiral, first man probably to come to the North Pole, not been proven though, and he was. He's had a family in Greenland when Robert left, his foster father, and he shot a polar bear when he was young, and he lived alone on an island. And the only friend he had to play with was a little polar bear cub that he brought back home. They became best friends and were together, slept together, played together, fought each other, and were best of friends. Then the polar bear cub grew bigger, then they had to let him loose, and they walked together, his foster father and Kali Piri and the polar bear. Now, this is your kingdom. You have to go. You can't be with us anymore, because you never know when they get, you know, what they could do when they get older. They might attack you. So the polar bear walked away and stopped and looked back, and Kali waved him, his friend, with tears in his eyes, said, "You have to go. This is your home." And he walked further, stopped and looked back, and Kali waved him for the last time. "Hope to see you later." Many years later, Kali became one of the greatest hunters of Thule area, and on a way trip back home from on the sea ice in Inglefield Fjord, one of the northernmost villages in the world are. And he was walking by a huge iceberg frozen in the ice, just to look how the sea ice was on the way back home and if there was any tracks by polar bears. And he fell into a hole in the ice. and he had climbed up on, and when and the dogs were outside and stuck with the dog sled, and when he fell into the hole, there was a huge polar bear inside that came running towards him. And he stopped and knew it was over. He didn't have a gun. So suddenly, when he came close, he stopped and looked him in the eye, like a little polar bear had done with him when he was young, when they were young. And he stopped and looked at it, and he touched his shoulder. And they looked at it, and he knew then by that moment that he wouldn't hurt him. Usually a polar bear would not let you go. It would just kill you. And so he talked to him and said, he knew, kind of knew him. I said, you have to go. The dogs will kill you. You have to run. And the polar bear ran up the hole, and Kali stopped the dog, said, no, we leave him alone. And he ran towards the ice, out on the ice, and he stopped and looked back, and Kali waved him, and he ran a little further and looked back again, and they waved, and he was sure that this was the same polar bear. So there's a lot of beautiful stories from that I wrote down from them. This was not a dog story, really, but it's a part of it. And Kendo is such a long story, but it's a beautiful story, too. And there were a few other stories of showing the heroic thing the dogs did or have done. So that book was to honor my friend Ule, who told me finally stories about the dogs. And to honor him, I promised him to make a book about it. And it's a part. It's like you're walking a ladder. It's the steps on the way to the North Pole. And we're making more books about the Arctic, like the big book about all 8 Arctic countries is our dream. And we are on the way. I hope the war will finish so we can go to Russia again and to the North Pole. So when that is done, then the book is ready. And then, yeah, we'll continue trying to show people what's really happening in the Arctic. It's the most difficult thing to do is photographing in the Arctic in the cold. I think it's the most difficult photographic project you can possibly have, other than war or something like that. But it's very, very. It can be fun doing it, but it's very, very difficult.
Okay, thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.